Hi there, can I help you? You're looking for something for the garden?
Well, I want to plant
what
for my...
What she wants is a nice lay landy hedge, am I right?
No, well...
And a lovely big hot tub.
Your vote is your voice, so don't let someone else decide for you.
Oh, and a pair of those crouching stone lions, they'd look great either side of your front door.
Do I know you?
That's our new trainee. He's very keen.
Make sure you're registered to vote. Go to checktheregister.ie and be a voter so that it's your voice that's heard. From Am Comisiún Toghcháin, Ireland's Independent Electoral Commission.
And would you like that for delivery?
Yeah. Apartment 3, 6th floor.
Oh, you're going to need a crane for those lions then.
Remember, you can stay up to date on the latest news with the Irish Independent WhatsApp channel.
If you like the Indo Daily, you can follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I don't think we've fully worked out the impact of social media on our lives yet. I think we are now entering into an era where there'll be far more regulation of social media.
I'm Philip Ryan, Independent Newspaper's political editor. Today, in a special episode of the Indo Daily, we have an in-depth interview with Taoiseach Micheál Martin in which he discusses the dangers of social media in the wake of the Leo Varadkar video controversy.
I don't believe in that sort of intrusion. I don't think it's right. But what would concern me is the degree to which it could deter people from getting involved in politics.
Reveals which ministries he intends on holding on to after Saturday's cabinet reshuffle.
On the housing front, I think we have over the last 2.5 years put the building blocks in place to really have a significant house construction programme for the next decade.
Said he will face down any challenge to his leadership of Fianna Fáil before the next general election.
As I say, I intend to lead the party into the next election. We do better when we're unified and when we don't have division.
And discusses the impact of politics on his family life.
I said to them they won't ignore it, but they do watch Twitter and Facebook. Now, what worries me at times is the degree to which it can influence thinking. Sometimes they may ring and say, look, what about this, Dan? I said, you're hooked too much on Twitter. Get off that.
Okay, so we are just 5 days out from Micheál Martin handing over the power to Leo Varadkar. And the Fianna Fáil leader is in the studio with us. So thank you for coming in and welcome to the Indo Daily, Taoiseach.
Thank you very much indeed, Philip.
Yeah, and look, so we're just going to get straight into it. And I think the changeover is happening. It's coming this week. I know you're not going to be able to say a lot of stuff. There's a lot of things you're not going to be wanting to give away just yet. It seems to be the strategy is that you just keep your cards close to your chest until you get to make the decision later this week. But I think a very basic one to ask you is health and housing. Fianna Fáil campaigned the last election on taking over those departments. Is that something you want to continue?
Yes, yeah. And in there are two very important areas that speak to fairness and justice in society. On the housing front, I think we have, over the last 2.5 years, put the building blocks in place to really have a significant house construction programme for the next decade. This year we will exceed our targets in Housing for All, which was published over a year ago. We've put in a lot of legislation to facilitate affordable housing, social housing, the Land Development Agency, cost rental. So there's a range of schemes. So there's a breadth and there's a depth and there's funding behind these programmes. So it's like a tanker in the middle of the ocean. I think we've turned that tanker around. Now we have to put the focus on delivery and delivering houses faster. And with that in mind, the government will be considering tomorrow very comprehensive legislation in relation to planning. And the largest consolidated bill in over 20 years will come before government tomorrow. The objective being to get a more streamlined, more accelerated and informed planning system to facilitate house building and climate change.
Just returning to the reshuffle, though,
imperatives.
In recent years, there's been a lot of changeover in portfolios. Do you think 2.5 years is enough time to really make a difference in a department or in a portfolio? Or should there be a little bit more time given to ministers?
That's an open question. I mean, I often at times think some more time should be given. On the other hand, I can recall my very first portfolio was education, and I had about 2.5 years there, and we did enough in 2.5, not enough, but we did a lot in 2.5 years. that to this day is being felt in Irish education.
But when you're dealing with a crisis department like health, like housing, is 2.5 years enough time?
Well, I mean,
because you have someone just reading into the brief again, like that's.
Yeah, but that question equally could. I know you have to ask the questions and so on like that, but I don't want to get into specifics as to whether there be changes or not in given portfolios. But suffice to say that the point you made has merit, but again, it has worked in different scenarios where people have gone the full Oireachtas term in the ministry, or others have gone 2.5 years and have managed to do a hell of a lot in 2.5 years.
So. But just sticking with those two departments, there's a confidence motion in your housing minister this week. It would be quite bizarre, I think it's fair to say, if you voted confidence in him and then sacked him a few days later. So I think most people can read between the lines that Dara O'Brien would be hanging on.
It would be bizarre if we didn't support our housing policy, and the Housing for All was passed by all of the government over a year ago. I think everybody realizes it's an opportunistic, in my view, motion. I think people generally out there in society want us to build more houses faster. Younger people are very impatient, are very frustrated with the options that they have, the prices, the fact that houses are very costly, rents are too high. So the most effective way of dealing with this is through supply. So motions in Dáil Éireann isn't going to change that.
And then on health.
Those putting forward the motions, I'm not hearing real alternatives or real solutions. I know those who've put forward a motion are against home ownership, full stop. But beyond that, I'm not hearing how they would solve the issues or add value to it.
Then it's long been said or suggested that you have an arrangement with Stephen Donnelly, that when he joined Fianna Fáil, that it was on the basis that he would become health minister should Fianna Fáil become to government. Is that the case?
No.
That wasn't the case at all. There was never an arrangement there.
No, not at all.
Okay, and again, look, I know you're not going to tell us what's going to happen on Saturday afternoon, but I suppose it's fair to say it's been well rumoured and speculated that you might return to the Department of Foreign Affairs and take up your work there again. You obviously have huge interest in the Northern Irish issue and the unification issue. I don't know if you read in today's paper in the Irish Independent, Barry Cowan suggesting if you were to take that up, that you should move on and appoint a deputy leader. So it would give you more time. I suppose the logic goes to keep an eye on that role while someone at home keeps an eye on the party and helps grow Fianna Fáil.
Well, I'll be driving ahead in terms of my role as leader of Fianna Fáil. So whatever portfolio I take will not in any way undermine my capacity to do what's necessary with all of my cabinet colleagues, by the way. All of the cabinet colleagues will have a role, as will ministers of state, as will TDs and senators, in driving on both the reorganisation of the party, but also in terms of the efforts to make sure that by 2024 we'll have a very strong, robust team in place for the local election. So already you may have seen we've had selection conventions now in Mayo and in other parts of the country in respect of the local elections already. So in the Cardiff Hall speech that I gave towards the end of October, I outlined a whole programme of events for the party in 2023, so that Fianna Fáil hits the ground running now in January. And I want to do that with all of my colleagues in government and in the parliamentary party.
Do you see yourself appointing a deputy?
Position I take. But I don't see that in the foreseeable
future.
What
is it that you have against having a deputy leader? You've only briefly ever had
Well, the party itself has only ever briefly had deputy leaders. It's not something that has been a constant over the various decades since the foundation of the party. And I think over time I've learned that everybody has a role to play in terms of the development of the party and the progression.
Worry that if you do appoint someone, you're essentially anointing your successor? Is that what the concern there is?
Not
political concern.
Not particularly, no.
But in some ways as well. Yeah. If you were to pick someone again, like you obviously picked Dara Cleary before. And
Dara did well, I mean, in terms of the work he did with the party. He works very hard on the ground with the party in terms of getting around the country and so on and understanding various issues and various constituencies. So, but I think all members of the cabinet and the front bench have to really get behind that. There can be a tendency of just leaving it then to two or three. And I think it's important that everybody gets involved and puts their shoulder behind the wheel in terms of growing the party.
Just, I want to bounce back to housing again. Just a quick one for you. Back, I think it was in 2015. You yourself, you're a quite regular critic of people who object to housing. But you yourself sent in an objection to 350 student accommodation units in your own backyard, in your own constituency. And in the objection, which you were, your name was signed on it. It says the proposition of accommodation for 350 students in this community would be a cause of great concern in the context of antisocial behaviour, noise pollution and traffic congestion, which has been well documented as having negative impacts on adjoining neighbourhoods. Do you recognise those comments, and is it something you regret at this point?
Well, at that time, there was a huge issue, and still is an issue in terms of the College Road area, in terms of residential areas feeling that they were...
But there's always an excuse, isn't there? There's always some local...
But I'm saying, I mean, I haven't made any observations since 2015, that's 7 years ago, and I've resolved not to, in any shape or form, object to any developments. And at that time, that was by the lock. No, the development has taken place, has happened, and it's well positioned now. To be honest, it's turned out reasonably okay. But I don't know. Are you familiar with the lock?
I'm not.
Well, you might get the context of it.
I don't expect you to be.
I'm sure
there's context to every objection.
Well, no,
there's
some
objections.
I mean, some people object to housing types. So basically, in other words, people either want 100%. Public housing on public lands, or the project doesn't get off the ground. So, like projects like Devonhay Gardens, Oscar Traynor, they were too long. I mean, it's talked about nearly a decade or more before some of those projects have even got permission to go ahead. That's the point I would make there. Mm-hmm. And I do think from here on in, and I've said to people, you know, those of us who have houses, the generation that have homes, have to think of the generation that's coming up that needs access to homes that are affordable, both either to rent or to buy. And then I also feel that we need a strong, consistent social housing program in and around 10,000 per annum, which we're now getting close to. We should be close to that this year. Between build, lease and purchase, we should make the 10,000 this year. But that has to be the way every year, because that takes pressure off the private market or the private rental market. But it also gives opportunities for people who can't afford to buy a house or to rent a house and incomes are low to get social housing.
Sure. Another passage I'm going to read to you. This time it's not your words. This time it's from the Comptroller and Auditor General, Seamus McCarthy. And this is in relation to overseeing the complaint made against Leo Varadkar when he was Taoiseach about leaking this document to his friend about the GP contract. And this is from Mr. McCarthy's submission on some concerns he had about the decision by CPOL to ultimately not investigate, saying he didn't have the power to investigate a Taoiseach. He said the respondent, which is Leo Varadkar, implies that any action in his role as Taoiseach judged by him to be appropriate / in the public interest cannot be questioned. If the document was not confidential, then this argument does not need to be considered by the Commission. If the document was confidential, then in effect this argument is that the Taoiseach has the power at will and without recourse to any process to declassify a document at his discretion. Is that your understanding of the role of a Taoiseach as well?
No. I think there are limitations to power. And I often say that to people, that we have checks and balances in our system. And, you know, people will often say to you in the street, you're a Taoiseach, you should get this done or get that done. And, of course, life doesn't work like that. We have a parliament, we have an Oireachtas, and we have laws that everyone has to adhere to. Now, in respect of that specific issue, first of all, the Taoiseach has acknowledged what he did was wrong. He's apologised. He went before the House. He was accountable to the House in respect of that issue. And in respect of the negotiations, there is a very strong argument that negotiations with doctors, you know, how confidential should contracts of that nature be in the first instance anyway? Because you're talking about the spending of public money on services that people will receive from GPs. And so one would have thought that irrespective of who did what, that that's a document that by definition is going to be a public document in any event. But there are limitations.
But it's a negotiation document at the same time.
But very often they get well flagged by the organisations, by the representative bodies, you know.
Do you ever get tired of defending the Taoiseach?
No, but I don't look at it as defending any one individual. I try and look at these things objectively as I can. Stand back from it and say, So for example, SIPA has made a decision.
But I mean, Seamus McCarthy, the Comptroller and Auditor General, is one of the most respected officials in the country, and his job is investigating how public money is spent, and how things are done. And he has pointed out here, and it seems that that even if you want to take the overall decision by SIPO saying that they don't have the power or oversight to look into what a Taoiseach does, is that a problem? And is that something that maybe needs to be addressed in itself?
I think fundamentally Parliament is is the body that a Taoiseach of the day is accountable to. We should not underestimate that, and that is enshrined within our constitution. I would be careful of sort of saying some members of SIPO are superior to other members of SIPO. There's some implication that could be the case in terms of commentary on these decisions. I think we have to, it's good that the transparency is there, but each member on SIPO is equal to the other, as far as I'm concerned, once they are appointed, irrespective of background, and they've got to give this the widest consideration.
Okay. You were adamantly opposed to governing with Sinn Féin the vast majority of your political life. Adamantly. It just wasn't happening. You didn't even consider it. But that has changed in the last 2 years. It changed, I think, on election day 2020 when the votes were coming in. What made the sudden change of mind?
I don't think it changed on election day. I think those comments I made, if you go back in any election day, I have a tendency. I think an election day is a kind of a watershed day because the people have spoken. So I tend not to be judgmental on election day. I tend to accept. My instincts are to accept the decision of the people no matter what it is. No, I didn't. And I think they were misinterpreted, the remarks that day, in terms of an immediate move, because we had made commitments in that.
But respect. You have softened your language around Sinn Féin.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't believe. I mean, this morning I was quite strong. I have very strong views in terms of what Sinn Féin has to do. I don't agree with a lot of Sinn Féin's policies in terms of Europe. I think they're consistently anti-Europe and haven't been called out on that enough. I think they, even in the most recent contribution when President Anne de Vlaanderen came into the Dáil, again, if you look at the contribution of their party leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, again, it was equivocal on Europe. There was this kind of, they're keeping back the capacity that they want to attack Europe and to be attackers of the European Union. And they rarely embrace what Europe has done successfully. So you have an anti-European party at its heart. Mm. You have an anti-enterprise party at its heart. And I think those are fundamental issues, and a party that's been anti-trade. And then there's the issue of in my view, this constant programme of Sinn Féin to rewrite history in respect of what happened during that 30 years of a campaign of violence that was against the overwhelming majority.
But that's fine. You've always stuck by those points.
I've not backed off those points.
You haven't backed off those points, but you've backed off certainly on the idea of governing with them. And I know, like, just on this other issue, just that we'll move on to the ongoing case in the Four Court or in the
Criminal
Court.
Yeah, but I just want to say, just on that point, I think, you know, I like to see myself as a Democrat. I'm clear. I think what should govern coalition governments is that the parties are closely aligned on policies and on issues. And particularly on election day, I do take time to reflect, and that's just a general trend of mine.
Look, I know you don't want to discuss, and we shouldn't discuss too much detail, but the ongoing case in the criminal courts is obviously raised huge questions for Mary Lou MacDonald. Do you think, after all is said and done, that she should come out and possibly even take questions in the Dáil on all that has transpired?
Well, I don't know whether a facility exists in the Dáil to take questions, but I definitely think there needs to be clear transparency on all of these issues. I don't want to comment on the specifics until the trial is over because of all the participants and so on. But very serious issues will arise, have already arisen, that will need to be the subject matter of a full public debate.
Okay.
And there has to be full transparency around this, not just in this specific area in Dublin, but more broadly across the country. As the military campaign of the Provisional Army ceased, you know, what happened to all of the money laundering exercises? What happened to all the funding that went on for the Provo War, as they called it? Did all that just disappear, and was all that struck down? And so there had been influences there that I don't think had been fully faced up to or acknowledged. And then there's the issue of weaponry. In terms of a lot of weaponry hanging around in the wrong hands in different parts of the country. And there's no doubt in my mind that the massive importation of arms that came in from Libya and everywhere else, not all of that, it would appear, it was decommissioned. And a lot of it got into the wrong hands subsequently. And it seems a lot of criminals have got hold of some of that cache of arms.
Could I just add, just moving on to kind of more personal issues, since you've become Taoiseach, I think you've been more open to discussing your family, your children even who passed away. I see today you were speaking about your son and missing out on football, on hurling games, was it? Things like this. And I was just wondering, was that important to you as Taoiseach, like to give the public a little bit more insight into your life, to give a bit more of yourself, let's say, to the public, once you took up office?
It wasn't done in a premeditated way. I think the first was an article by Jenny Hogan, which was on parenting.
Yeah,
and I said I agreed to do the article via my press office and so on. Mm. But then when you're actually doing an interview on parenting. Mm. It seemed like a proper context when the questions were put to me, and it was done very sensitively. But it always is very difficult, and it's very difficult for the family in particular. And then the next occasion was the Meaning of Life program with Joe Duffy, and that took me on when I was actually doing the program as well. But it's not something but what I found from the Jenny Hogan article was that I got a lot of correspondence. Which I didn't expect from parents who went through similar events and tragedy and traumatic events. And there is some merit in sharing your experiences, that others may resonate with what you said or be in a position to say, look, actually, that's how I felt about it. And that means something to me, what you said on that program. And that certainly has caused me more reflection. It's not something, because I was always anxious not to do it in a political context ever. But it has given me food for thought, the fact that people have written to me. I'm not great at writing back or engaging, but I will when this hectic phase is over. I'll recontact people who have gone through very traumatic events and who found the interviews helpful.
Mm. But you say the family found them a little bit difficult.
Okay,
look, the whole country has been talking about it over the last week. This video of the Tánaiste that's been doing the rounds on social media. And just before we started recording, you were talking about how the advanced social media is becoming, and this metaverse type thing where people will be able to record everything that they're looking around with their pair of glasses or something like this, Google glasses. And I suppose, do you think there is too much intrusion into a politician's lives these days? Or because you were a politician, are you public? Are you there for the public to consume?
I don't think you are. I don't believe you are. I don't believe in that sort of intrusion. I don't think it's right. I think what happened was a breach of privacy, fundamentally. Now, I do accept that in the world of social media, it's an ever-present reality, perhaps, or danger. What would concern me is the degree to which it could deter people from getting involved in politics and participating in politics. I don't think we've fully worked out the impact of social media on our lives yet, or on a public debate, or on politics. And I do sense that there would be quite a number of people very reluctant to become involved in politics because of this sense that they're that everything to do with their lives will be scrutinised. And so on, and then that is a concern in terms of the impact it will have on potential politicians of the future.
But I know attempts are being made to regulate it at present. But when the emphasis is being put on the companies, but is there an emphasis to be put on the members of the public as well about how they use social media or what they're willing to post or what they're willing to say online?
Well, I think the platforms have to be, there has to be a lot of pressure on. And to be fair, I think a lot of companies are doing a lot of work to try and take hate speech off, to take a lot of material down as quickly as it goes up. And I think there has to be responsibility on individuals in society as well. Now, trying to regulate that is extremely difficult. Because there's all sorts of balances between free speech at another level. And it's a very difficult space. And now there is a lot of legislation coming down stream in terms of the Online Media Bill, for example, which would be a significant Digital Services Act. So Europe is bringing a lot of regulations. So I think we are now entering into an era where there'll be far more regulation of social media platforms than perhaps there was. There is a lot of regulation already on the privacy side, but right across the board now, I think there's more level playing field being created between the traditional mainstream media and social media,
and that will
demand huge resources, by the way, from the state in terms of the new online media regulator and the online media commission, which or the media commission.
But you're a politician, so I presume you get a lot of abuse online. Do your family see that? Does it impact on them, or do they just keep away?
Well,
from
I said to them they won't ignore it, but they do watch Twitter and Facebook. And what worries me at times is the degree to which it can influence thinking, almost without people realizing it. So I kind of say, if sometimes they may ring and say, look, what about this, Dan? I said, you're hooked too much on Twitter, get off that. Because that's only one perspective. And get out there and meet people and talk to people and on the street and so on like that, and you might get a different perspective. So I think I've taught them to be rather immune to it, and that all sorts will come on. Sometimes I'm interested in going through some of the commentary to see where they're coming from.
You put yourself through it, do you?
Well, only from a research perspective. Is that a far right kind of trend? Who's engineering it? No, I'm not good at that, but I mean, it seems that a lot of the reactions can be engineered.
Do we have people monitoring it within your team, or
not really.
I mean, as a state, even like as
no,
a,
no, we don't. No,
that, like
no,
that.
No.
That's,
we can't. No,
it's hard to monitor. Look, your term is almost up, and you say you're going into the next election again. Isn't that correct? As Fianna Fáil leader, you will lead the troops. How many seats are you thinking you're going to get? Well, what's the target?
Well, a lot depends on the census and the Boundary Commission, and we could have more seats in the Dáil overall. But certainly we want to go higher than where we are now. A lot will depend on the pipeline of candidates that we develop in the context or between now and the next local elections in 2024.
You're not tying yourself down to a figure just yet.
But we want to significantly increase the number.
I don't know if this has been asked of you before, but like you're determined to stay on, but if someone was to challenge you, is that something you would relish? Would you take them on?
I wouldn't relish a challenge like that. No sane leader would.
Didn't do Enda Kenny any harm.
But I work with my parliamentary party, and I will engage my parliamentary party. And I think a collective unity of purpose approach is best for the party. I've realised.
But to anyone out there considering taking on Micheál Martin, what would you say to them?
But in the last two elections, we did well. Sorry, in 2016 we did very well, because I think there was very strong unity of purpose coming into that election. We do better when we're unified and when we don't have division. And that would be my experience.
But would you take someone on?
Well, I intend to lead the party into the next election. And that has implications. But
yeah. You know. Okay. And is there anyone there that you see as a natural successor?
Well, there's many people in the parliamentary party who could succeed me. Many, many people. And it's a talented party, many talented individuals. A number are in cabinet, some are not in cabinet. There's no fear for the party into the future.
Where do you rate yourself amongst the Fianna Fáil leaders of the...
Well, I haven't rated myself yet.
No?
And it's different circumstances and different times.
You're a lot longer tenured than a lot of them.
Yes. Not as Taoiseach, perhaps.
Well, not as Taoiseach, no.
But as leader, yes. In a different context, again, coming out of the crash, the financial crash. Long period in opposition and so forth, but it's I think politics is something that I like engaging in and meeting people and getting around the country and so on like that, and then being in a position to take decisions. So, so I think from my student of history hat on me, very often people are judged, I think, best judged in the circumstances they find themselves in the context of the times that they're governing or leader of the party in.
As a party, let's say, I think it's fair to say in some regards that the reputation of Fianna Fáil was tarnished by some leaders. If you look at Charles Haughey and some of the things that came out about him over time, the problems Bertie Ahern had with tribunals, and even the time of the crash around Bertie Ahern or Brian Cowan. Do you think that you've helped move the party's image from then to one that's a little bit more squeaky clean than would have been seen in the past?
Well, I think, to be fair, I think overall... And there have been bad patches in the party's history, but equally there have been very strong periods as well. I mean, I think, to take Brian Cowan, I think he led in the middle of the crash well. He didn't look at it from a political perspective or through a political prism, but he took decisions with the late Brian Lennon that had to be taken. Now, electorally, they had the results and so on, but from a country's perspective in terms of the four-year plan and doing what had to be done in the midst of a crisis and acknowledging that, I think something I'd like to say on his behalf, because I think that's a positive legacy. Mistakes were made earlier in terms of budgets and so on like that, and then you had a global financial crash. I think Bertie Ahern's legacy is the Good Friday Agreement. And
you don't think it's tarnished by the tribunals?
Obviously, the tribunal was not a...
You forced him out of the party over the tribunal.
No, but it wasn't good for him. I acknowledge that, and I think greater clarity at the time. But you can't take from him the legacy of the Good Friday Agreement and what that meant for the island.
But you did force him from the party. I think that's fair to say. Well, I know he took a decision on his own.
He took a decision to resign.
Jump before a push scenario.
There was a context at the time, but he took a decision to resign. But
and you see him coming back into the party. You've said in the past that he's now a confidant. You speak about the Northern issues all the time. Do you see this proposal that has been suggested that he come back into the party?
I think that's very possible. I believe he is interested. He has retained his interest in Northern Ireland. He speaks to more than me in relation to the North. He's involved with a group of former political leaders and also community leaders in the Unionist Loyalist side. To try and get an understanding of where they're coming from on various issues. And he's also spoken to Simon Coveney and others also.
But you haven't made the offer just yet, have you?
Not just yet, no.
Will you?
Yeah, I think, as I say, it's every possibility. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming into us and speaking to us ahead of the big day. And best
thank
of
you very
luck.
Much indeed. Thanks, Philip.
Yeah, thanks. My thanks to Taoiseach Micheál Martin for joining me today. I'm Philip Ryan, and today's episode of the Indo Daily was produced by Mary Carroll with sound by Gavin Hennessy. If you enjoyed the Indo Daily, don't forget to like, follow, and leave us a review.